you know, the vulnerability that you submitted that wasn't a vulnerability that you told other, you told
this is very,
no, Joel, listen,
I love the energy. This is veering very closely into blackmail.
It's not blackmail. What's up, y'all? If you've listened to Critical Thinking for any time at all, you know that we very often cover the Asset Note team's research that they put out on enterprise security and zero days that they've been popping left and right. And lucky for us, now the team no longer just has a blog, but they've got a podcast called Surfacing Security, where they talk about everything enterprise security related and attack surface management related. And I've been following each episode, and just listen to these episode titles, okay? Internet-wide recon, moving past IP-centric approaches, very interesting. Beyond shadow IT, understanding the true attack surface of your software. This one's focused on like third-party softwares and how they can affect your enterprise security posture. And the unknown complexities of DNS resolution. Guys, these guys know DNS resolution like no one I've ever met. I've probably spent 10 plus hours just discussing DNS resolution and their DNS pipeline with the Asset Note team. And they know their shit inside, outside, upside down. So if any of those sound interesting to you, check out the new Surfacing Security podcast on the Asset Note YouTube channel or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, back to the show. Yeah, I'm spinning in my chair. Come on, groove with me a little bit, Joel. Come on. Dude, it's pretty solid, right?
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good, man. Shout out to our boy YT with the new Corsair Captain song he dropped on SoundCloud this week. It's pretty good stuff. Let's cut to a longer clip of it. Let's go.
Should just leave it. We should just leave it like that. No longer clip. No. Just
no, Richard, don't do it, Richard. Don't even think about it. No, dude, that was great. Shout out to YT, dude. I don't know if we've given, you know, we've put in the show notes every week that he did our intro like for free very quickly, and I just so appreciated that. And so I just wanted to give a little extra publicity, just a little extra publicity to his new song. It's a banger for sure.
Yeah, totally.
Some of these lyrics, man. Hold on, let me find. When the sun goes down is when I'm doing all that dirty hacking on the Gibson while I'm chilling with a pretty girly. I love it.
I think we can all relate.
Oh yeah. Solid. Very solid stuff there, man. All right, dude. When I opened up Twitter this week, well, first of all, for those of you on YouTube, let me just flex this amazing hacker tattoo that I've got here that I finished up this week.
Oh yeah.
Looks pretty good,
very
right?
Nice. Yeah, dude. I saw the pics. I was surprised because I knew you'd said that you were gonna do it, but I didn't know when, and then you just did it.
28 hours under the needle, Joel.
Yeah, that's well, it is a full arm sleeve. Yeah. Further, well, so
yeah, a forearm. Yeah,
I still got to
do the backside here. You know, like right here, because when I'm looking in the mirror, like check this out. You know, when I'm looking like this, you can't even barely see I have anything beside the band.
Right? Yeah, what's the point of having tattoos if you can't see them all the time?
That's what I'm saying. Long sleeves, I'm done forever. Always gonna be rolled up now. How long does it take?
It's gonna be the middle of winter. Justin's in like short sleeve, sleeveless shirt. It's like, ah, this weather. Oh, these?
Yeah,
these are my tattoos.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't know you saw them.
Please tell me I'm not that cringe. If I look Dude, how long did it take you to do yours? Because yours is a flash, right?
Yeah, mine wasn't too bad. I want to say it was like, I don't know, an hour and a half or something.
Hour and a half, not bad. Yeah, dude. The guy that did my tattoo, Ninja Eater, he's actually a hacker as well, and he's sort of retired from tattooing and is just doing hacking stuff now. But he's amazing, man, and he did it very in depth. And one of the crazy things about this is that it doesn't like even afterwards, you know how a lot of times when you like put the wrap on it or whatever, it will like the ink will like bleed out and it'll yep. like it, so it didn't do that at all. And I'm like, nice. How did you do that? And he's like, man, I don't know. Like a lot of tattoo artists, they just like yeet the ink in there, and I just kind of you know put it just deep enough. And I'm like, dang, dude, that's pretty skilled.
That's so awesome. That's awesome.
Shout out to my boy Ninjeater. Thanks for the tat, man. Yeah. All right, dude. Now that I've said my piece with that, I opened Twitter this week, and what do I see? Ron Chan, man. Ron Chan.
He's back.
Remember our homie? He's back.
Hell yeah, I remember him. Ron's my man.
I'm very excited to see him tweeting some stuff out, and he has got a so for those of you that maybe aren't familiar, because I know he's kind of jumped in and out of the space a little bit. Ron is an amazingly talented hacker, and he was in the live hacking event circuit for a long time, and just really impressed all of us that were there. And now he is back on the Bug Bounty Twitter scene with his new startup, AuthZ AI. What do you think, man?
It certainly seems really interesting. He made a tweet the other day that was very very accurate, I feel like, where it was basically like, you know, the idea is that, you know, you get enough people using your tooling that they go, oh, this is really interesting. Who's making this tooling? Then you like contract to the company who's making the tooling for like pen tests and that kind of stuff. So I think like that's generally the business model. And I think like when you think about like tooling, like it's not usually it's something that you're already going to be creating. So it's not necessarily a time sink to be creating that tooling and like distributing it for marketing purposes or whatever. It's you know, it's helpful for your business, and it's something that you're already planning on using. So it kind of just like streamlines your process as a business, and then also gives you opportunities to flex sort of your capabilities. So
yeah,
I think it's really cool. I like it.
I think so too, and I think it's a good application of AI, right? This whole permission, you know, AuthZ permission scheme thing. Like, I feel like that's pretty ingestible into AI, and then a lot of what makes that difficult to test for is something that an AI could actually, you know, wrap their head around pretty easily, I think. I'm interested to see what the sort of ingestion process for this whole thing is going to look like. You know, and he said he's found some bugs with it already, and but just the whole like you have I feel like it'd be really amazing if you could just like somehow provide a screenshot of like the permission matrix or whatever, and somehow like a multimodal AI would grab the data out of there, synthesize it into a format that this can deal with, and see what it can find.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it seems like, looking at the repo for this, it seems like you give it somewhat of like an open API-esque description of sort of like how your API works and the auth around it and all that kind of stuff, and then it will do the analysis. So it seems really, really cool, and I'm excited to see what other stuff that Ron's going to be creating, because he's super smart and talented and always has lots of good ideas.
Yeah, dude. This is definitely a cool intro. I'm surprised he... You know, I'm a little on one hand, I'm a little surprised that this is open source. I think, like you said, you know, it plays to the business model of like, you know, we'll open source this and it will convert into business for the actual consultancy. But yeah, I feel like the AI stuff right now, it's pretty hot to like make it into a service or something like that you can use. But he decided to open source it. So solid.
Yeah.
Solid.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It'll be really interesting to see. I'm still not sure how I feel about the whole AI bubble thing. Like, I think it's definitely cooled down a lot. So we'll see what happens. Like, I think, you know, as with any new technology, there was sort of that like explosion of new startups and ideas and concepts and all this wow factor stuff. And now it's sort of chilled down a little bit to some of the more practical, realistic implementations of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it'll be really interesting to see how this progresses.
Have you played around much with O1 preview and like the whole thinking stuff behind
that? Yeah, I use that as like whenever I'm doing anything that's like not service level, like, you know, reinterpretation of data or whatever. Like if it's if I want it to actually like give me something that I'm more confident about the results, I use O1.
Okay. Solid. Yeah, that makes sense. We just an anecdotal experience, but you know, Mariah and I play volleyball, and Mariah's team captain, and she's responsible for doing the rosters, right? You know, and like putting people mm-hmm. at their various spots on the field or whatever, on the court. And she tried to give it to ChatGPT sometimes. She'd be like, all right, this person works well with this person, and like, this is our setter, and you know, and just describe it all. And before, it just totally failed. We play co-ed, right? So it has to be guy, girl, guy, girl, guy, girl. And it was putting guys next to guys, and it was like, it was a mess. So I'm interested to see if the O1 preview can do a little bit better on some of those more technical tasks. And I think it probably will.
It probably will, because like, you know, the whole thinking thing is basically just like using the AI to check the AI, mm-hmm. right? Where it like, it'll output something. And I think the natural thought for us is like, if it gets this wrong, why do I as a human have to be like, no, you're wrong? And then right. it'll be like, oh yeah, you're right, I am wrong. Like, it should just do that on its own. And so that's kind of what it's doing, where it'll look retroactively back and be like, here's what I output. Does that make sense?
did you do the thing right? No, I didn't.
And it'll be like, actually that doesn't really make sense. So I'm going to redo it. So that's good. So I, you know, it's a very sort of natural like way of going about it, I think. So I've definitely seen, I think somebody told me the stats are like that on like the programming questionnaire or whatever, like when they fed it into the 4.0, it was like 20% or something, or 50% or something it got through. And then when they gave it to O1, it was like 80%. So
wow.
it was pretty good.
Yeah. Dang. I also feel like a lot of the problems that it fails on, it could output code to solve. You know, like if I say output code that calculates the possible iterations of this team's like volleyball structure, then I think it would be able to do that pretty well. But then, you know, if you just ask it to do it, then it's like, well, hold up. Like,
It, and I think what you'll notice is if you click it, if you expand stuff, this has happened for a while, but like ChatGPT as a whole uses code to do a lot of what it does. So if you're look at this picture and tell me what's going on, it will write a Python script that OCRs it, and then it will run that Python script. And if you expand like what it's like thinking about or whatever, it'll literally just be like writing a Python script.
Oh, that's cool. That's like the code interpreter thing. Is that?
No. This is just like normal. Like if you ask it to do more complex tasks, it will end up just writing a piece of code that does that task and running that code.
Well, of course, ChatGPT thought of that. That makes sense. I didn't just come up with this crazy idea to like that all of these genius people over at OpenAI didn't come up with. All right, cool. Well, we got a little derailed there, but let's swing back around to this blog post that we wanted to cover this week on Ophion security from our boy Rojan. I love how Rojan always goes after the very fringe parts of a company. Like you never see Rojan just like, yeah, here's an IDOR on dub, you know, like he's always hitting like the ticket system, the live chat system, that sort of thing. And I think this one turned out pretty impactfully for him.
Yeah, absolutely. He's always doing really cool stuff. I used to work with Rojan, and I was really excited to hear that he was going to start this security company. Mm. And the stuff that they've been doing lately in terms of like research and stuff is really, really awesome. So yeah.
It's a very good model, exciting, man. To see. Doing quality research and then, you know, using that to as lead gen for your...
I mean, it's like, you know, what better way to show that, like, you know, you're capable, you have capable security folks by other than doing actual security research. I mean, think back to even just how like HackerOne started. Like HackerOne's whole business model originally was hack these companies, give them bug reports and be like, hey, do you want to start a bug bounty program? I think that sort of like results by example type stuff is really, really good.
Yeah. I thought you were gonna go with the cake story for HackerOne. Have you heard the HackerOne cake story?
The cake story?
I think I was talking to Yobert or maybe it was one of the other founders at a live hacking event, but he was pretty much saying like in the beginning, one of the ways they would say, one of the ways they would get customers or whatever was like, hey, if we can't hack you, we'll buy your whole office a cake. And then they, you know, they always hacked them, so it's fine, you know, but
it's such a low risk.
Yeah, but I'm like, but I mean, somebody walks into your office.
Trade
like,
offer. Oh. We hack you or we send you a cake.
That's pretty good. I liked that though. Innovative marketing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and let me just go ahead and share my screen because, I met with our video editor yesterday and he said that I should share my screen more so that you guys can get some stuff on the, like some visuals or whatever. Okay. So this is the write-up from Rojan here and, Ophion Security. And I thought this was a pretty insightful little graphic here. I don't know if it's big enough to see, but if not, we'll make it visible. But essentially, it explains the flow for how some of these live chat authentication systems work. And it starts off with you know, the user coming to your website. And essentially, on the back end, it generates an HMAC digest using the user's identifiers and secret key, dumps it back, and then passes that to, you know, in this example, HelpShift, but in other scenarios, other live chat services. He said this was you know, a trend he saw across a couple of them. And then that's what is used for authentication. So it's a pretty you know, reasonable flow. The problem with that is that you're leaving a lot of this authentication up to the end user. So what we see from the example that he dropped here is that they were just using this underscore SVPT cookie with an email address value in it. And it was just dumping back the actual, you know, it put the email address in there and it dumped back the auth token. And so, you know, when we're trusting, when we're trusting that end user there or the end user of the live chat software, to deal with that correctly, there's definitely some room for error, especially on these systems that sort of get, I guess, duct taped into the whole flow. You know, and that really goes back to what the Asino team was just talking about a couple of weeks ago on their surfacing security podcast for like these third party softwares that are taped into your main app are often the weakest point. I feel like I often overlook these, especially when it's something like this, where it's like, oh, I needed to weed out all of the cookies to find that just this underscore SVPT cookie was what was handling auth.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think those integration points are super, super important because it's made to be easy, mm-hmm. but that often means that assumptions have to be made to mm-hmm. make it easy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. So I'm definitely going to make sure I look at these. I've also recently found a vulnerability in the live chat system that affected like www and was pretty gnarly. So I feel like this might be a surface that a lot of people look at and be like, third party stuff, I'm not sure I'm going to touch that. You know, it's probably used on a lot of website, but I think it's also an attack surface for a good amount of, like if you get a 0 day on it, there's a lot of impact that can be sprayed across a lot of companies. And so that's a good place for research, I think.
This is pretty topical, I guess.
Here we go. Hacking third parties. Yep.
Yeah. Speaking of hacking third parties and affecting other companies. Right. So there's this whole Zendesk thing. Yeah, why don't we talk about that?
Okay, all right, we're opening up a can of worms a little bit here. Yeah, dude, I don't know. I mean, this is the main topic for this week, right? Like, and I kind of wish that we had jumped on it a little bit more when it was fresh, right? But I think I just wanted to at least mention it and debate it a little bit here because I think there's a lot of nuance to this situation, but the principles apply pretty broadly. And for those of you that aren't familiar with the what I'm entitling the Zendesk fiasco, there was a 15-year-old researcher, clearly very skilled, that found a way to, let's just say, pwn Zendesk, right? It was regarding the email system and being able to leak the contents of any help desk ticket. And they reported to Zendesk, and because it has some of those like keyword indicators, right? Like what was the actual one? Like the email security
email
headers.
Spoofing.
Yeah, email spoofing, right? You know, 99% of the vulnerabilities that you get through your bug bounty program that contain email spoofing are going to be informative or NA, right? But this one was valid, and the team ended up closing it as informative, and the researcher was like, of course, okay, well, you know, if it's not a bug, then I guess I need to tell other companies about this because I think there's risk and maybe they will think of that too. And then it just started raising a bunch of problems for Zendesk because all the third parties were like, whoa, how did you leak all of our internal ticket data? And then Zendesk was having to deal with a fire on their hands. Right. So I don't know, Joel, I know you have a little bit more program side experience than me. So maybe there's some nuance to the situation I'm missing, but this seems like a pretty clear misstep by Zendesk to me.
Yeah. So, I mean, generally it seems like this entire thing was a pretty bad miscommunication between parties. Like, I don't know if Zendesk uses H1 triage. Mm. I don't know if that was disclosed in the write-up. Mm. H1 staff.
They do. Yeah. So H1 analyst. Yeah, so they do. Yeah, Layla was the one that.
Right. So triage screwed this up. Mm-hmm. Like they said, okay, this is email spoofing. So it didn't even reach the customer team essentially at that point. Right. And then they, I believe the researcher did mediation. Mm-hmm. And then mediation also said, this is spoofing. This is email spoofing. Mm. So it's not going to count.
Yeah.
And then at that point, like, I don't think, like, I understand the researcher's thought process of like, oh, maybe other companies want to hear about this. So like, it's been marked as like not an issue by the program. So I'm going to like, I'm free to report this. Mm. I don't know about that one. Like maybe like,
yeah, what is the correct route for the researcher going forward then, I wonder? Like, if you went through the mediation process, if you've tried to get your report re-looked at and they won't do it, you know, what recourse does the researcher have at that point, I wonder?
I mean, I don't know if they necessarily do have recourse. I think, like, the fact that they went around Zendesk afterwards and it happened that companies agreed that they cared about it from an impact perspective, I think is kind of, to be honest, more of a luck sort of situation thing than anything. Like, realistically, the fact that Zendesk didn't think it was something that needed to be fixed in the beginning also, well, I'm assuming that they had to have that discussion at some point because when you go through mediation, like, you're going to get reached out to directly. So they definitely had to review it at some point. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's unlikely that that's
mediation that is the case.
Yeah, like it would be highly unlikely that like the mediation case would have been closed without any interaction from the Zendesk team at all. So they probably had to view it and be like, yeah, okay, this is not something that we're going to accept. And like the fact that other companies who had Zendesk were like, actually, okay, this is something we want to fix, and it ended up falling sort of upstream back to Zendesk. Like, I think that doesn't always happen. Like, you'll definitely find cases where companies will be like, you know, even if it is something they do care about, they'll be like, well, how are we supposed to fix this? Like, there should be a fix from Zendesk. Mm. Like, if there's no fix from Zendesk, then, you know, do we need to report to Zendesk? Or like, you know, and then like as a program manager, I'd be like, well, is this a zero day? Like, we should be reporting this to Zendesk before it comes to me. Right. So, I don't know. I think like it all sort of falls back to that initial case of like Zendesk being like, no, this is out of scope for the program. Mm-hmm. And then when it started coming back in through you know, the customer channels, Zendesk should have reopened the report and said, you know, we are actually going to fix this, and just they could have handled it that way and it would have been very easy. I think going the route of, you know, you violated our program terms by reporting this to other companies and stuff, like, not something I would have done. Mm.
Okay. Wow. That's an interesting approach to it. I think for me, where the buck falls there is that when it was closed as informative and the mediation process ended, I feel like the hacker doesn't have any other recourse at that point besides reporting it to other programs.
Well, it's more so there's this whole concept of implicit agreement, right? Mm-hmm. Where I think a lot of researchers like they kind of like to try and ignore this or like think that it doesn't exist but from a program side, it's like basically the only like agreement you have with the researcher, which is that when you submit something to a program, you're agreeing to the program's policy and terms, and that, you know, you're not going to disclose the details of that vulnerability without the permission of the program and all that kind of stuff, like by submitting it, which is why when, you know, if you want to do a disclosure after 90 days, you should never report it through a bug bounty program. You should submit it to their email, right? Like, and I think that's, I don't think that's like groundbreaking knowledge or anything, but like that is really the lens that you need to look at it through, which is that like, you submitted it to the program, which means you're now in like a semi-binding agreement with that program about, you know, that vulnerability. And you can't then go turn around and disclose it to other companies without the permission of, you know, that program or whatever. Like, you know, there are certain things. And
I just feel like it's not like a vulnerability though at that point, right? Like if they're saying informative or NA, then why is this bind? And I think this might be, and this might be where the rubber hits the road here. This might be an H1 problem with regards to the terms and services, right? Because I think there should be something that says, hey, if a report is informative or NA, then this is not something that the program is actively. But then you get into those scenarios where it's like you close something as informative because it's out of scope, but it's actually a valid vuln, you know? I don't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's definitely a little bit on both. Like, again, like H1 Triage was the ones who kind of screwed this up initially. And then H1 Mediation as well, like pushed again. Like, from if I was managing the Zendesk program, and I look through this and I'm seeing all the backlash, I would have reached out to Akron and been like, hey, what's going on here? Like, I think we probably should have accepted this. Why was this decided as email spoofing twice now? And, you know, it just would have, like, in terms of like the agreement stuff, like the policy stuff, I view HackerOne and the programs as sort of like similar to like the US, like federal and state system. Right. So like HackerOne is like the federal government in the sense that they set overarching policies and rules and stuff, but the programs themselves can override those just like states can. So in that sense, like a program can say like we don't follow the program guide, like the platform standards of XYZ. This is how we handle it instead. You're allowed to do that. So I think, you know, Zendesk, like on one hand, HackerOne can say like, and they probably do, you're not allowed to report or disclose vulnerabilities, you know, without permission from the program. And, you know, you'd be violating that on the HackerOne side. And Zendesk also could, and I think they actually do. Let me look.
Yeah, in the response.
Yeah, so in Zendesk's policy, here we go. Share the details of reporting. Share the details of any suspected vulnerabilities with the Zendesk security team by filing a report. Please do not publicly disclose these details outside of this process with explicit permission.
Yeah.
All right, so the publicly keyword there, you know, we could go back and forth on that. But I think like really what it comes down to is you're not supposed to disclose details of a vulnerability without explicit permission from the security team with anybody. In any format, right? Like whether that's sharing it with your friend or sharing it with a company who's affected or sharing it publicly on a blog. You know, I think like the program team went and they said, you know, we're not going to fix this. So the researcher, to cover their ass, they probably should have just commented and said, hey, is it all right if I report this to companies who are affected to see if they want to fix it?
They disagree, yeah.
And you know,
and the
if
thing
they
is,
say no, then it's like, okay, well, why not? Why aren't you going to fix it? That's like a separate discussion. But I think, you know, if it's like either you fix it or you allow them to disclose it to the affected companies and see if it wants to be fixed.
Yeah. And I think the thing is as well, we didn't actually see the full details of the report that this hacker, HackerMondev sent into the Zendesk program. And, you know, I'd like to believe that report was very detailed in showing impact and stuff like that. But I know that this is a tricky situation for HackerOne, right? Like it looks like an email spoofing vulnerability. Given the nature of Zendesk and how many vulnerabilities there have been relating to email bugs with Zendesk, I would hope that there would be something, in writing for the triagers that are working on that program saying, hey, email related bugs should take we should take an extra look at those on this program because there's been some scary shit that's happened, because of that. But it is possible to give the program the benefit of the doubt. It is possible that the hacker didn't show excellent impact. The problem is his write-up was really good. and so I really don't think that's the case. So I definitely think there wasn't a lot of recourse for him. And if I were in his shoes, I probably would have done the same thing. And I went to go and look at that hacker's profile, by the way. And he's got like 3,000 rep on HackerOne. So it's not like in a 6.4 signal, right? So I feel like this is a misstep. Not by HackerOne. Like it's not like he's a fresh account. First report is like email spoofing. Let's go.
Yeah.
He's got to establish.
Yeah, because I don't even think you can do mediation if you have no signal.
Right.
Like there are certain limitations. Like I don't know. I think as a whole, like there were multiple missteps in terms of communication and process here, and. I'm going to hold my tongue here a little bit in terms of my real feelings, but I will say I think this is a systemic problem with all triage services where trying to put a generic puzzle piece into a complex solution tends to fail at scale.
Yeah.
Right. And that generic puzzle piece is triage and the complex puzzle is a per program vulnerability validation solution. Mm. And when you start having a team of people whose job is to just validate vulnerabilities, it becomes less and less about nuance and context to the program and how to handle specific vulnerabilities for specific programs and more about, is this valid? Yes or no? Checkbox. Binary 1-0.
Yeah.
And is it reproducible? Yes. Does it fall into these categories in the policy that are out of scope? Yes or no? Right. And it becomes a lot more difficult to make those nuanced decisions at scale. So they don't.
Yeah.
And then you have these problems.
That's the nature of the beast. And I would have liked to see HackerOne, and maybe they did and I missed it, but I haven't seen it, send out some sort of PR statement on this specific incident because it did get a lot of press.
Yeah.
And I would have liked to see them take responsibility for it because at the end of the day, we can see clearly from the write-up that, the first triager closing it as informative and then the mediation team not fully validating it was a misstep. And I think there's a lot of grace, right? Because it does have that weird, this is probably not an issue vibe to it. But when you look deeper, it does, right? So if HackerOne had come out and said, hey, our bad, just want to publicly apologize to HackerMondev and say like, hey, we messed up that one. I feel like the most of the community would be like, yeah, we get it, man. Email bugs. Yeah, right.
I think like probably the reason that they're kind of just doing non-action here is that HackerMondev did fine.
Yeah.
Like he made plenty of rep, plenty of money, plenty of whatever from this. His stats are fine. Like there was one, like the root cause instance of this went poorly, but like the overall outcomes, fine. Yeah. Like they're not going to pull into the make it right fund for this. Like he made plenty of money. Like, so it's kind of a tricky situation. Like in terms of process, they definitely could have done better. That is something I would be interested in seeing is some sort of statement about, if there was a process failure here and whether or not triage should have said, yep, this is spam, and whether or not mediation should have also said, yep, this is spam, email spam, and or email spoofing. Mm-hmm. And, just like some clarity on that, I think would be good just to know whether or not that's what actually went wrong or whether it was, just a miscommunication or whatever. But otherwise, they don't have anything to really make right in terms of, because again, it's like there were multiple reports that got resolved, got paid out, all that kind of stuff on the affected companies. And it's just this one that was like, what, informative? Like,
it's yeah.
A, yeah. Like, and it, not it, even an impact to it.
Yeah. I think Naugli, just in sort of agreement with what you're saying, Naugli had a great reply to one of my tweets. It says, he was very fortunate that Zendesk initially closed this as informative. Otherwise, he would have made 1K max instead of 50.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I see that. I see that, you know. I think that's
like,
valid.
I'm not trying to minimize the outrage, because I think, like, again, it certainly seems from the outset that, like, there was a process problem, that something went wrong, and, you know, maybe there needs to be more clarity about, maybe there needs to be a specific call out for the triage team doing Zendesk stuff or whatever, like, I don't know, whatever needs to happen, but, like, it does feel like something went a little wacky there. That being said, exactly what Naugli said, like, one report closes informative equals 50k amount is said, right? So you know, it could be worse.
It works out in the end. I did reach out to H1 and say, like, hey, do any of you guys want to, like, come on the pod and talk about this scenario, because it did blow up a lot, and none of them took me up on it.
That's odd.
So we'll see if they send out a statement at some point. But at the end of the day, I do sort of agree with what you're saying here, which is, and what Naugli said as well, which is that in the end it worked out better for him.
I guess HackerOne's PR team is hard at work still.
Yeah. Well, I think he also got a lot of good PR out of it too, you know? Like, he's our boy now. Like, if I see this 15-year-old dude, I'm gonna be like, sup, dude? Like, Zendesk really screwed you on that one, didn't they? But I also think that the response was not great from the Zendesk team either. Like, I feel like at the end of the day, Zendesk, this is what gets me a little riled up, Joel, okay? Like, I get HackerOne making mistakes and not taking responsibility for it. I get it. It's a big company now. Whatever. It's not our little baby like it used to be back in, you know, 2017 or whatever. But, I think the Zendesk team should have done something differently here. Because at the end of the day, clearly, once they get hit by a bunch of customers saying, hey, fix this, hey, fix this, hey, fix this, now they know it's a problem. And they go back to this report and they have the audacity to say to this kid, hey, you shouldn't have disclosed this, even though we, you know, the process failed you. And, you know, even though we overlooked this report and said this isn't a valid vulnerability. And so they say, hey, the researcher did something ethically wrong. And I don't think that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that all, again, as I said, I wouldn't have handled it that way.
Yeah.
Going back and saying, like, oh, you broke our policy. Like, literally nobody would have found out about this if you just were like, sorry, we fucked up.
Exactly.
Here's a 3K bounty.
Yeah.
Resolved.
Like, dude, then he would have been excited. This would have been great for the Zendesk team, right? You know, that would have been great.
Please stop reporting it to other customers. You know, like, yeah, I don't know. I feel like, whatever. So, again, not how I would have handled the situation. It is what it is. I think there are valuable lessons that have probably been learned from all parties involved. You know, from the researcher side, like, you're just because a program closes something as informative or whatever, that you're not immune, right? Like, you still agreed to program terms, you still submitted it to them, that vulnerability still falls under the guidelines of the program and the platform and everything, and you can't just, you're not just off the hook because they said, nah, this isn't something that we're gonna fix. From the program side, like, if you're getting a lot of pushback about something, give it a little manual look. From the platform side, like,
or just learn how to say you're wrong, right? That's the thing that a lot
it's
of
not
these,
easy, but yeah.
I mean, these companies and their companies or whatever, and you know, people's careers are probably, you know, gonna take a hit or whatever here. So maybe it's a little bit easier for me said on the outside, where my mistakes are, you know, saying something stupid to my wife versus, you know, screwing some hacker out of some money, but in a big PR scenario. But I feel like it's not that hard to say, hey, sorry about that. You know, that was my bad. And that's just kind of what I would have expected. And now everybody hates the Zendesk program now, you know, like that had a ton of comments underneath it being like, what is wrong with you guys? Like, wow, this response is garbage, you know? So I think in the end of the day, it really didn't pan out well for Zendesk. And
they left a comment on the fucking GitHub.
Yeah.
I, yeah.
I know you're trying your best to be. Come on, let it fly a little bit here, Joel. Come on, let your true thoughts fly.
I think Zendesk needs to get the PR team that HackerOne has.
Yeah.
Because
interesting. It doesn't take
genius to be like, maybe we shouldn't engage publicly on this. Like, when has that ever panned out well? Mm. Are you kidding me? Like, what? Like, you literally, like, there was a public forum where people were commenting and, like, shitting on you. And then you were like, I know. Let's engage directly.
Yeah.
And, like, commented on it. Like, and then they started getting added by all these people being like, no, you're wrong. Like, oh, man, way to stoke the fire. I don't know. It's just really, I don't know. It definitely feels like the security team is on damage control here, not the PR team.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Okay, let me run this last thing by you, okay? So when I was reading this and I was all riled up and I was mad for my boy Hacker Mondev here, my 15-year-old lead hacker, I was thinking, I feel like Zendesk needs to be punished for this behavior. and I'm thinking it would be interesting to have a list of programs that have notably treated hackers in a way that doesn't make any sense.
You know, this is really interesting coming from you.
Why?
Because in like the first 2 weeks of us starting our Discord, there's a very similar idea that was floated. And they're like, what if we have like a reputation list of like bad experiences with programs? Yeah. And we were like, no, this is a terrible idea because it's literally just going to create a witch hunt spreadsheet where people are going to be like, I had a bad experience with this program, and then nobody's ever going to hack on it. Even if the program like management changes or policies change or anything, okay. It's just like,
my idea has matured since not then, productive. Joel. No, it's matured. And I appreciate you being here to tell me I'm crazy when I'm crazy, and that's fine. You know, I appreciate that. That being said, the idea has evolved a little bit. Okay. So this is a list that is maintained by us. So that will be a little bit of logistical overhead, but, there will be only hackers of certain reputation can make submissions to this list. Hackers that have successfully interacted with programs time and time again and aren't like just tilty because they got, you know, hecked up on one program or something like that. And it would also have to come along with a historical reference for the behaviors that they exhibited that are negative towards researchers and a remediation step that the company can do to get their program removed from this list. And like, for example, in this scenario, if Zendesk just paid the bounty and said, sorry about that, then everything would be fine.
Okay, but some of that is impossible. Like, now, what is Zendesk supposed to do to get off that list?
They're supposed to say, hey, so we put up the, you know, let's say Zendesk was an entry on the list. We'd say, hey, this scenario was really poorly handled. And then they engaged the hacker and they said, hey, you know, the vulnerability that you submitted that wasn't a vulnerability that you told other, you told
this people. This is very,
no, Joel, listen.
I love the energy. This is veering very closely into blackmail.
It's not blackmail. It's caring.
You're saying we're putting you on our bad program list. And if you want to get off the bad program list, you have to do what we say.
I'm just saying, like, I think that
isn't
this
is that.
Did I just invent blackmail?
I mean, I think so. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for the fact check, Joel. It's just an idea, and I think that it would provide some accountability for programs that are mistreating hackers. And we know that there are programs out there that mistreat hackers. And you and I both
know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That maybe, we have these discords, better... and people say, "Hey, guys, don't hack on this program because they did XYZ." And then everyone's like, "Thanks, bro. I would never hack on a program that does that. Thanks for the heads up." So why don't we just formalize that?
Well, so what I'll say is...
Besides the blackmail component, which...
I'll say is, like, I think I've had plenty of those experiences myself. But for every one of those, there's also an experience where it's like, and I had this really bad experience with this program. And the person I'm talking to goes, really? I've never had a bad experience with that program. And that happens pretty frequently as well.
Yeah.
So there's that side of it. And the other side is, I think it would probably be better handled by like an independent third party. Where like, I think the general idea here is that like,
Are we not the independent third party?
No, because we have conflict of interest. I think like that's the idea is mistreatment of hackers That definitely happens, right? And so I think probably the best way to go about that is either the platform have some sort of
the freaking platform.
Either the platform has like an audit committee of some kind where, you know, a hacker can say like, I feel like I'm being mistreated by this program here. And it's somewhat of like a legal system, right? Mm-hmm. Where like they submit a case and they make, you know, here's my evidence or whatever. And the program can defend it. I think it's something that could get out of hand, right? So that needs to be handled somehow, where like, you know, if you have a bunch of hackers who get mad at a program or whatever, or like this program can't be spending a bunch of their time like debating or arbitrating or whatever in the hacker court, like about hacker whether or not they're mistreating hackers.
Five domain.
You know, I think like some sort of an independent committee or process is probably a better strategy, where like, you know, from like a systemic level where you're talking about, where like a program is treating hackers poorly time and time again on multiple instances in similar ways, then that can be, you know, addressed from sort of like a platform side, where the platform goes, hey, like, you know, if you want to stay on HackerOne, then you need to either change your policies or
at the end of the day, you're right. I think probably that list is not the best idea. And I think this is best handled at the platform level. And it would be cool if there was an independent third party like hackercourt.com, whoever owns that, like, let's go, where there was some accountability for that. But if the platforms themselves take responsibility for the way that these programs are running, then we won't have that problem. So I think that there could be a world in which we have a petition system or something like that, where if the community says, hey guys, this is messed up, H1, you need to review this, you need to have some stance on this, and we get, yeah, you know, like 1,000 signatures on it, whatever, then HackerOne's like, all right, look, we'll take it under, we'll have a statement, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the strategy is like, maybe not a petition system, because again, this can all be like community, like you can rally people and it gets unfair and then you can force things to happen. But like, I think maybe like an anonymous like review, like, I think this program is causing problems unjustly. And once they hit a certain threshold of reports of that nature, then there's an investigation that happens like by a human, not just...
Does this
fall in the
policy? Or maybe this does exist internally at HackerOne. Who knows? But it would be great if the hackers had a little bit more introspection into this progress or into this process. And I think also this also all rolls back to the thing we've been talking about for forever, which is hacker unionization. And I think that this is something that would be shut up, Joel. This is a real conversation, okay? This is something that would fall under that purview, right? And I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think it's necessary, but this is something that
hackers are going to strike.
Well, that's a good point.
Where's our leverage?
Well, I think there's a lot
of
leverage.
We're independent contractors.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, you know, there's you know, billions of dollars in companies that are associated with hackers doing what they do. So we do have leverage on the platforms. We don't have as much leverage on the programs, but we do have leverage on the platforms. If we say, hey, listen, we're not going to hack on HackerOne until this stops, then I think we are at a pretty leveraged point. We are the product.
Yeah, we don't pay any bills.
Yeah. But the platforms the programs aren't going to stay on the platform if there's no hackers hacking on the platform, right?
I mean, they can't just up and leave.
Yeah, they've got like service agreements or whatever. Yeah, so it'd have to be an extended thing, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it would have to be like minimum probably 6 months to a year.
Makes sense, dude. Makes sense. All right.
Well, maybe I shouldn't be giving you ideas.
No. Thanks for the sanity check here. Thanks for holding me down, man. I appreciate that. I think that's a wrap. You got anything else?
No, I think that's it.
All right, GG. Peace.
All right, peace.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for listening. And if you want more Critical Thinking content, head over to ctbb.show/discord. Join the Discord. There's lots of great conversations and chats going on over there. And if you want to support the show, there's the Discord subscriber tiers, which give you access to masterclasses, AMAs, hackalongs, exclusive scripts, and an exclusive chat channel with us. We'll see you there.